This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. William Holmes. Today is April 26, 2004. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. It's about 9:35 a.m. Central Standard Time. And Mr. Holmes, you are in Boulder, Colorado.
Correct.
Why don't we go ahead and start with a brief biographical sketch of yourself, sir. Could you tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
Okay. I was born October 4th, 1939, in Greenville, Texas, which is about 50 miles northeast of Dallas, and grew up the first 6-7 years of my life was there, and then moved to Lubbock, Texas, where I stayed and in fact, lived until I went through college in, at Texas Tech, and entered Texas Tech in 1957 and managed to cram 4 years of hard study into five, and so I got out and graduated in June of 1962 after changing majors a couple times.
Okay.
Graduated with a business administration degree in banking, finance, and investments, a degree I'm currently using and have used for about the last 30 years in, as a financial consultant and money manager consultant. Currently with RBC Dane Rauscher in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay. Tell me about Greenville, Texas. What was that like?
Greenville was a small town, kind of interesting. I remember Time magazine once had a picture of the sign over the city that caused quite a stir because it said Greenville, Texas, something, maybe Hunt County, the blackest land and the whitest people. And so you can imagine as the culture got more into racial things, I think in the 1950s, or maybe even earlier than that, they made them take the sign down. But that, I grew up in a town of probably 8,000 to 10,000 people, a small town with a lot of typical farming and family value type of orientations, a lot of really good quality people, kind of salt of the earth folks. So.
Right. Tell me about your family. What were your parents like?
My mother was an only child and grew up in the Depression and had some significant what I call Depression mentalities from that. She grew up as a teenager, and I remember saying her saying she had to borrow $25 to go to school. She did. Being pretty goal-oriented, she did go to East Texas College, State Teachers College, which I guess is now East. I'm not sure exactly what the it's East Texas University probably now, and she got a degree in teaching. My father was someone a tremendous role model for me. Graduated from the University of Texas after going to Virginia Military Institute his first year and a number of things. Very quiet, civil engineer type that was a city engineer in Greenville, Texas, and then moved to Lubbock and became city engineer and then eventually director of public works in Lubbock. And then left that and went to work as a part owner and vice president of James Prentice Gravel Company, which has a large gravel operation in Slayton. So he followed his civil engineering duties. When I was very young, he entered the Navy as an officer and went to mine warfare school and was on a minesweeper, the YMS 300, which was a wooden minesweeper and with the old saying of wooden ships, iron men type of thing. They swept the harbors in the far east of Shanghai and so forth during World War II. And he used to send me shark's teeth and things they could do. And tremendous role model, a very quiet guy, but very principled and just a true gentle man, and he died in 1995 of Alzheimer's, and we watched him go through about a 4-year, very tough situation there. My mother is still alive, living in Lubbock, and is at Winsong, I guess I don't know what it's called, Retirement Center or whatever, mm-hmm. but she lives there now.
Okay. Any brothers and sisters?
I have a sister that's 10 years younger, Kay. She lives with her husband, Jimmy Ojibwe, mm-hmm. Down in Belleville, Texas, where he is president of a Wells Fargo Bank branch there. They have three children, all who have gone to Texas A&M and are dyed-in-the-wool Aggies. two of the two boys have graduated, and the younger girl, her daughter, will be graduating, I believe, this coming December.
Okay. I imagine you were too young to have memories of World War II. Is that right?
Not really, because I was pretty young. I was in the 4-year-old mm-hmm. area, I guess, then. I was born in 39, so I was 4 or 5 years old, and I remember my parents putting me in the car, and we would go to Virginia, to Norfolk, Virginia, for mine warfare school for my father, and then he got transferred to the West Coast, where we went and said goodbye to him. We lived on the West Coast to Long Beach, California, for a while. Mm-hmm. But I remember the long trips, obviously, as a kid. It was, many, many days, and then going back through Greenville, Texas, on the way through, and
right.
Saying, how long are we going to be till we get there? I remember mother getting letters, and I got letters from my father. So that part of it, I remember kind of it as a child, but
right.
no other memories, no.
Okay. How about the Korean War?
The Korean War, I remember, I think the thing that sticks in my mind is how those poor soldiers fought in that tremendous cold.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, my drill instructor in the Marine Corps, I don't remember his name, but I think he had a couple of toes gone from his tour in Korea, in the Korean War.
Right.
So that's pretty much my recollection of it. I was a youngster when that happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about your childhood, Bill. What was that like growing up in Greenville? Then you moved to Lubbock when you were
yeah.
pretty young. What did you do?
I think I had a pretty normal childhood. I had a younger sister, who was always young enough to get in the way, and then when I came back from Vietnam, I realized that she had grown into quite a beautiful young woman
mm-hmm.
in just that short a period of time. Pretty much normal in Greenville, elementary school, and we lived in a duplex while Dad was overseas, and then he came back and got a job as a city engineer for Greenville, and then we was able to get a nicer job in Lubbock, and
mm-hmm.
we moved to Lubbock, went through grade school there, probably second or third grade, and pretty normal growing up childhood, played, enjoyed sports. My father was pretty much a workaholic,
mm-hmm.
but so I didn't. He wasn't really didn't foster a lot of athletics, but encouraged me, of course. But so I didn't get a lot of athletic training when I was a kid. But I loved golf and was one of those kids that was not only small but slow. So, so I didn't do too well in basketball or football or track. But I did enjoy golf, and I started playing that in high school, I guess, or
mm-hmm.
Maybe a little earlier in junior high school.
Mm-hmm.
And have played golf for a little over 50 years, so that's been my passion, avocation life.
It's a good sport to play. Tell me about Lubbock. What was Lubbock, Texas like?
Lubbock was flat, and I never forget the night to my mom. My father was off to some type of council meeting or something, and we live right next door to one of these wide-open cotton fields, and you
mm-hmm.
can see the dust storms, the red line of the dust coming up. This was before Lubbock became very cultivated, and one night I woke up to hear my mother cursing in a kind of a dark haze in the room, and
mm-hmm.
the back door had blown open, and one of these cotton fields was blowing in the back door,
oh,
and she had found some 10-penny nails, and she was she was probably cursing my father for moving her there. but the words I heard coming out of my mother were something I'd never heard before. And she was nailing the back door shut, which had blown open. And so that was probably kind of a typical early experience of the real fine red dust that Lubbock experienced then. And I guess it probably still experiences some to some extent. But cultivation and the growing of trees, most of which in Lubbock, of course, were planted, has dropped, I believe, those dust storms down considerably. But they used to be a major factor on the South Plains.
Mm-hmm. What was your schooling like? What kind of student were you?
I would say an average student. I think when I got to college, I was just hanging on by my fingernails. I've always been the type of person that's really more enjoyed doing things than reading about them.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, I don't think I think there's probably something in my eyes where they don't focus as well. And every time I sit down with a book, I get very sleepy. So I'm not a recreational reader, nor have I ever been a really good reader, but I really had to grind in school to get what I have, and I made very average B's and C's. I made very few A's and was not a very good student, but I think I've been, you know, that's translated, a lot of that experience is translated into hard work and so forth over the rest of my life, so
right.
It's worked pretty well.
What were your favorite subjects as a kid?
I think probably math, trig, algebra. Algebra stands out probably as being my probably one of my favorite subjects. And I tend to be kind of a somewhat anal, organized person, and I think math appeals to that type of person. So now that I look back at it, I enjoy history, but I didn't enjoy memorizing history and doing. I probably least like civil government and those type of things. English now to me has become rather fascinating, and I'm always respectful of people that can take the English language and do wonderful things with it, and descriptive poetry and so forth. And I've become somewhat of a lyrics writer for songs and a little bit of poet, but that's about it.
Okay. Did you work when you were young?
Yes. I worked at my father's gravel plant. Probably the toughest job I had was the graveyard shift, 5 in the afternoon till 5 in the morning, working, rolling big boulders off of a gravel hopper where the big Euclids would come up and bottom dump their gravel. And a Mexican fellow and I would work all night rolling those things off of the gravel. And I remember many mornings trying to go home without going to sleep on the road from Slayton back to Lubbock.
Right. How old were you?
I was probably in the teens then, and probably 13, 14, somewhere in that neighborhood. And the valuable experience there was learning a lot about the mechanics of a lot of the heavy equipment works, but also I learned some Spanish because this fellow couldn't talk any English. I couldn't talk any Spanish at the time. Well, I took a little bit in high school. That was a valuable experience because he learned English, and so all he had to do was talk.
Right.
When we were heavy manual labor there. Later on in high school, right before I went to college, and part of the time I was in college, I worked in a men's clothing shop, Maloof's, for men out there in Lubbock, and that was a nice experience as far as just buying clothes and stuff like that.
Right. Okay. So was it expected that you would go to college, or was it something that
I
you
think
had?
It probably was, yeah. You know, I think at that age, that was a sort of the big goal, you know. In fact, they sort of gave you this impression that if you went to college, there, you know, once you got that diploma, there'd be a long line of people out there just waiting for you, you know, to hire you. And, of course, now that's become more difficult for a lot of people, but and obviously that wasn't true, but that's kind of the carrot that everybody held out for you at that time for a lot of young folks, I think.
Right. Was it always going to be Texas Tech, or did you look elsewhere?
You know, that's a really interesting story. I don't remember ever looking elsewhere because I didn't think I could really afford to go anywhere else. I did live at home. I didn't ever lived in the dorm, and I went to school, so all I had to do was pay in-state tuition. And we were not a very well-off family at the time. My father eventually rose to, and he was a very good saver and investor, and pretty frugal, and mm-hmm. so he and my mother grew to be comfortable in their later years, but we didn't have a lot of money when I was growing up.
Okay, so
it was about, we were a middle-income type of family, I guess, middle to low-income, yeah.
Okay, all right. Tell me about going to college in Texas Tech. What was that like for you? You said you already spoke to you about your grades and kind of being an average student, but what else was going on?
Well, I formed a friendship with a bunch of SAEs and eventually went and pledged and went into the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity mm-hmm. and enjoyed that. I felt that gave me sort of a grounding there. I have never been quite candidly a very good alumni, although I attended a 50-year reunion of our chapter, not a reunion, but a 50-year anniversary of the Texas Alpha chapter there at Texas Tech last year, and that was a lot of fun, seeing a lot of old friends. But mm-hmm. I've never been I'm not a very good alumni supporter of Texas Tech. We're here in Boulder, and we have season tickets to the CU Boulder games, and so we go to those. But I look back at college as a good learning experience. I don't look back at it with fond, longing memories like a lot of people do. School was tough for me. I was not a very scholarly person, and so my memories of school are one of a lot of good friendships and a lot of fun, but also a lot of really hard grinding.
Mm-hmm. This was, you entered in 1957?
57, yeah.
Okay.
Graduated in 62.
Okay. Did you play sports at all here at Tech?
I swam a little bit on the freshman team. I was a pretty good swimmer and diver. And I tried to play golf on the freshman team. I can't recall really whether I made it or not, but I remember there were a lot of really great state golfers on the varsity golf team, and I had two chances of making that, none and nunner. So although I enjoyed the golf, there were people here there that later on won the Texas Amateur, that later mm-hmm. on went to be professional tour players, and they just had a tremendous quality, much better than I was.
Right. Tell me about getting interested in the Marine Corps. How did that happen?
Well, interestingly enough, it's kind of a fluke. I had gone through Air Force ROTC for, 2.5 years or something like that.
Here at Texas Tech?
At Texas Tech.
And how did you get into that? And why did you get into that?
That's a good question. I think, you know, the military was always kind of instilled into me. My father had done it, and so
right.
I thought it was, the right thing to do. I've changed my opinions on a lot of the nationalistic fervor that's created in our young men, but that's another subject.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was the thing to do, and I participated in the drill team. I was a really good marcher and also became quite good at drilling and fast changes of directions and so forth in the ROTC. And did pretty well in the Air Force ROTC, had a lot of friends, a lot of fraternity brothers in there and so forth that were the upper senior officers in the ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
About my junior, probably on my junior year, maybe late sophomore, junior year, I flunked chemistry. And when I did that, I was forced to take freshman chemistry over. And when I did, that kept me from taking some courses like international politics or political geography that were requirements for the contract that you go into in the last 2 years of ROTC. So I had to give up my contract
okay.
that I just entered into with Air Force ROTC,
mm-hmm.
and I still wanted to go in the service, so I found out I could enter the Aviation Officer Candidate Course of the Marine Corps, and that I, after school, I would immediately go into boot camp and then flight training, because I did want to fly. And I had the eyesight for it and all, and passed the physical and so forth. The last part of about my senior year, I think they put me in the active reserve, even though I had not been to boot camp there. So I went to the monthly meetings, I guess, is it? Yeah. And then I went into the to the officer candidate course, which is effectively a six-week boot camp. I went in there, and as I came out of it, they needed more officers in the ground corps than they did in the in the aviation deal. So they said I had a slight astigmatism in my one of my eyes, and that I could not qualify for pilot, so you automatically go in the ground. I said, okay, well, make me an air control officer, and they did. And so my idea was to go in and become an air control officer until I could get accepted to F Force Phantom School, which was a back seat job as a radar intercept operator, RIO, and because that's what the Marines were flying. They had a radar intercept operator in the back, and they had a pilot in the front. And I said, if I can't be a pilot, I want to be a radar interceptor. So they put me, they shipped me after the initial 6 weeks officer training. I got my commission, and then they, all Marine Corps officers, they send you through a six-month infantry training course, whether you're a dentist or lawyer or whatever. Right. Everybody in the Marine Corps goes through that to become an infantry platoon commander. So I went through that 6 months. Then they shipped me to Cherry Point, North Carolina, Marine Corps Air Station there. Mm-hmm. And I was in a VMF squadron, which was a fighter squad, E-4 fighter squadron. Mm-hmm. And I served in there just sort of doing nothing. I played a lot of golf at Cherry Point. And they were, it was kind of a waiting ground for me to get into RIO school. Then, at that point, they changed the requirements for being a RIO for up to 6 years service. And after I'd been in that type of out in the real Marine Corps for a while, I decided that I didn't want to be spend the next 6 years of my life after I got through with the RIO school in the back seat, and so I just said, okay, let's cancel that, and I'll serve out the rest of my term as an air control officer. And so they put me in a Marine Air Support Squadron, MASS 2, and which was the 2nd Air Wing's Marine Air Support Squadron, and eventually we were shipped to Da Nang.
Okay. Tell me where your interest in flying came from originally.
I don't know. I think probably I just, the romance of being a fighter pilot was something I had in the back of my mind, and I'm very glad I didn't do that. Fate was pretty kind to me, because my attention to detail, which I think you need since watch my wife, who's a pilot and has her instrument rating, and I fly with her some, I've realized that I don't have the attention span, although I really have attention to detail, but I don't like sitting in some place and having that attention span focused on one thing for so long. Mm-hmm. And so I probably would have not made a very good pilot. In fact, I probably would have crashed on some of my carrier qualifications.
So this was something from your childhood that
yeah, probably. I don't think it was really a burning desire after I think about it now either.
Okay.
I think it was a good, it was something I wanted to do, but it was just kind of considered a normal career path, that I would become a Marine aviator, and you know, from there, well, who knows.
Was ROTC good for you at Texas Tech?
Yeah, I think it was good. I did a lot of things I enjoyed. The drill team was particularly enjoyable in my early years, so that was fun.
How did you do in that military type lifestyle? You know, it's kind of it's not total theater tech in the ROTC level, but
it's a lot more. You're a lot more. I think I sense that you're a lot more ingrained now in the ROTC. That it takes more time. All we did is on Thursday we dressed up in our uniforms and wore those to class, and participate in drills that afternoon. We went to some ROTC classes, but we didn't wear our uniforms all the time, you know, and it was not as maybe structured as it is now.
Okay.
I would assume. I'm just guessing.
So in 1962, when you did graduate, Bill, you were looking right at going into the Marine Corps.
Yeah, that was my only option at that point because I,
What did you know about the Marine Corps? I mean, did you know about any kind of reputation about being them being very difficult in training, or was this something that was a challenge for you?
Yeah, and that didn't bother me, but the one thing that I liked about them is I knew that everybody that went in the Marine Corps was a volunteer. So if you're in a foxhole with somebody and somebody's shooting at you, at least that other guy was there voluntarily, at least one at one time in his life he wanted to be there.
Right.
That was, I guess that sort of philosophy of pretty good discipline and esprit de corps was pretty important to me at the time. Mm-hmm.
Was it what you thought it was when you first got into it?
Somewhat, but as I look back at it, and particularly in Vietnam, I got very discouraged with all the politics of the service and the politics that the generals even play, you know, with young guys' lives and sometimes the power struggles and egos that go on, which are normal stuff in life, but I had to learn that, you know, as a young person.
Right. Tell me about your initial training in the Marine Corps. You went to OCS?
I went to Quantico, Virginia, and went to OCS. It was just like boot camp.
1962?
Yeah, let's see. I went... It probably was.
Or did you go the summer before your senior year?
April of 61, I went in. Yeah, I probably didn't. April of 61, I went in and started going to the, maybe it's December 61. I went in to the active reserve.
Okay.
I served in the active reserve till I graduated, like in June. Then I went to Chicago for 3 months waiting to go to OCS school, and I think September 62 I went into to OCS.
Okay. All right. What was Quantico like?
A very Marine Corps-oriented town and center. You know, it's I don't know that it's much different from any other military type base or whatever, but it was a very, you know, very secluded, very focused on one thing. That was the Marine Corps.
Right. Tell me about training. What was it like for you?
It was tough. I think the thing about the Marine Corps, and maybe this works in all of the services, I don't know, is that the Marine Corps tries to push you right up to your limit and see how. And they're very good about taking you up to that limit and taking you back down. Hopefully they take you back down. I guess in some cases they haven't. I was a skinny guy in pretty good shape. I wasn't in great shape, but when I went in there, when I came out, I was in excellent shape. So it was a tough training, but nothing really, you know, jolting or surprising about it to me. I pretty much knew what the training was going to be like. Mm-hmm. I talked to a lot of people, and I was not one of these people that went in scared, although there were people that went in to that couldn't do one chin or one push-up.
Right.
One pull-up or one push-up, and obviously they didn't fare too well. It was okay.
What was your typical day like there at OCS?
I'm trying to remember what time we got up. I remember we used to have this drill instructor used to, on Sunday mornings when we were supposed to sleep late till like 6:30 or something.
Right.
We used to pick up the big steel GI can in the middle of the squad bay, which was never had anything in it, of course. It was white glove inspection, but it always was there. He'd pick it up with those big handles and just, he was about 6'4" or something. He'd pick it up over his head and he'd just take it and roll it all the way down the squad way between all the two things. And I remember hearing him say, candidates, can't you hear those church bells ringing? Get up, get up, get up. You know? And he was something. But what was your question?
Typical day there at OCS.
So you get up, you do calisthenics, and then you generally have some type of training. Sometimes you'd have studies that you do in the classroom stuff, and then you'd normally have the meal right on time, and at a certain time to eat, amount of time to eat, and then you're always running, always under pressure. Basically, they want to see how you do under pressure. So.
Was it brutal in any way?
I don't think so. I might have seen one person slapped or something like that, but nothing that we didn't feel like they didn't deserve. I don't no open-fisted hitting or anything like that. I had a pretty although my drill instructor appeared to be never smiled and appeared to be pretty mean. I think he operated within the rules pretty much, and he wasn't going to do anything that was goofy.
What kind of weapons training did you have there?
Let's see, M14. And I still have the stock, my M14, and that's one of the things I didn't give you. It's got my name on it. What is it? 50 caliber machine gun training, anti-tank rocket training. I mean, we went through artillery training. I'd never became an artillery officer, so I didn't get the fine points. But you get all that, mortars, I mean, every type of handheld rocket launchers,
How did you do with all that?
Pretty good, pretty good. I was pretty good shot. I was an expert pistol shot, but with the M14, I don't think I was very strong, so probably just a marksman with that. But
what was your relationship like with the other candidates?
Good, good. There were a bunch of guys from Texas. There was one big guy. I forgot what his name was. Moody. That was in our deal. That always was bragging and yelling and just made almost an ass of himself. In officer and the big braggadocious Texan, you know. And a couple of others of us just kept quiet and never really told much about where we were from, they couldn't believe later on when they found out that this other fella who was from Weatherford, Texas, and I were from Texas, that we weren't loud and boisterous like this other fella, because that was the impression they had. And I remember one of the guys from New Jersey in our squad, in our Canada training, said something to the fact that at one time I used the word "you all," and he says "you all." He says that must be plural. He says like we say in Jersey, like "use." And so we had a good time. We had a couple of guys in there that were shipboard Marines, very very sharp individuals that had been recommended for officer candidates course. So they were going through boot camp for the second time, but one of them was a Private Gregory. I remember a big black kid that was just really sharp. And in fact, they did this march around the squad bay when they first got us there, and they'd yell, "One, you're supposed to be in your rack, in front of your rack, standing at attention. Two, you're supposed to be in your bed, sitting up at attention. Three, you're supposed to lie down." And they'd march you till you were the opposite end of the squad bay from your particular bunk, and then they'd say "One," and it was just a mishmash. And this guy was a big, strong black kid and a very gentle, nice guy. But I bumped into him in one of these drills, and he caught me in the ribs with his elbow.
Right.
And it broke, fractured a rib, my lower rib. So I went through a lot of the training with a fractured rib, which I will not forget, because every time you breathe, you know, and you were doing a lot of taking to the limit type of calisthenics. But that happened to me about the last two or three, three or four weeks of training, I guess.
Did you not seek medical attention?
No, that was not. You never wanted to rock the boat in that thing.
You didn't want to draw attention.
And it wasn't that bad. It was, you know, it hurt when I breathed a little bit, but it wasn't like it was sticking out or anything like that.
Okay. Tell me about John F. Kennedy. This is in 1962. Is this summer, fall, basically? 62 is when you're at Quantico?
Yeah. Trying to remember. Yeah, are you talking about when did he die?
He died in 63, and I was just
curious. Yeah, I was on the golf course in Cherry Point, North Carolina, when he died. John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I think he was a pretty well-respected guy, president. And is that what you're
yeah, talking? Exactly. In the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 62, and just what your general impressions of being in the Marine Corps officer.
I don't remember candidly having a distinct opinion of the president at that point. Of course, he's a commander-in-chief when you're in the Marine Corps, and so, you know, you would never utter anything. I don't think I didn't have an opinion of him, to be honest with
okay.
you, other than he was my, you know, CMC.
Right. How long did OCS last?
OCS, I believe, was 6 weeks, and then you go into what they call the basic school for 6 months. That's
yes.
You're an officer then, but you're, and you have a nice room and so forth. You're sharing with another officer, but... And unless you're married, then they had actual people who had were able to live at night, go off the base, except when they had bivouacs and things like that in the 6 month basic school,
mm-hmm.
live off live in the married officers' quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a few people in our basic school, but six months is devoted to making you capable of being a platoon commander.
Right. Before we move to basic school, tell me about graduation from OCS. Did your parents come out for that?
Yeah. A big deal in Quantico.
Yes.
I've got pictures somewhere of all that. I didn't give you folks those. But,
right.
But, yeah, I remember that. And it seems like they brought up a girlfriend of mine, an old girlfriend out or something, that I can't remember too much about that. But yeah, it was quite a deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you went to basic school. What was basic school like?
Basic school was like a gentle boot camp for officers.
Okay.
Once you're an officer, you have a certain respect, but then the drill instructors become captains. And so, you know, they're no longer drill sergeants. And they don't dress you down like the drill sergeants did, you know, get right in your face.
Mm-hmm.
But they do... they did, you know, grade you and a lot more classroom stuff. Of course, a lot of bivouacs, a lot of physical stuff. They had a deal one time, I don't know where this is worth mentioning, but on the cold ground, we all saddled up. In other words, we'd get somebody on our back with their legs through our arms, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I weighed about 135 pounds or something at that point.
Wow.
And I was on top of this guy that weighed about 180, 190 pounds. And the idea was to play horses, and you'd go over and try to push other people over.
Okay.
And we were just kicking ass and taking names. I mean, we were pushing people over and having a good time. They said, okay, now switch. And he got on top of me. And somebody... I think blew on us or something, and we started down, and his foot that I had under my right arm
uh-huh.
went right in my knee,
mm.
and I heard a pop there, and so it definitely tore the cartilage in my knee.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, right before I came back from Vietnam, I went to Okinawa for about a month or two and had the cartilage removed.
Okay.
From my right knee, the inside cartilage removed from my right knee. So that was a deal in basic school that I I came out of that. And then I try to go and play basketball or something, go up for a layup shot and come down on that knee and on that leg and it just crumple. I wouldn't have anything under me. So that was probably the biggest injury that I suffered from the whole thing.
It seems like you kept getting injured.
Well, no, that sounds... I mean, those were the only two real injuries. But,
right.
you know, if you didn't have a sprained ankle or something occasionally or, you know, cut yourself a little bit or something at
mm-hmm.
some point, and this, I mean, it was rough training. It wasn't torture. It wasn't... but these were just things that happened. And
sure.
I was not the strongest guy around either, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty small guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me what kind of tactics and things they taught you to be a platoon leader.
Basically, it was leadership and leading the men. And you really learn the real code in the Marine Corps is kind of, if you don't take, and it's not a negative thing, but if you don't take care of your men, they'll take care of you. And a lot of lieutenants, I'm sure, have been shot in combat by their own troops because they were arrogant or they... But the main thing you learn is to take care of the people under your command.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a real concern for those people because you're a team and you fight like a team and you learn to really consider those people because they're your support. And I developed a very healthy respect for and you won't always have a gunnery sergeant in a platoon, but you know, but for the gunnery sergeants and the sergeants, the guys who'd been around for 10 years, you know, and weren't fortunate enough to be an officer if they wanted to. Some of them, didn't, of course, wouldn't want to be. But and I listened to their advice when I went to Okinawa. I went to Okinawa right before we went to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
And I had a gunner, and everybody was up. When you go to Okinawa, you buy a motorcycle because that's the cheapest form of transportation. And there's always somebody leaving, so I bought this big 300cc heavy Honda motorcycle. Mm-hmm. And this gunnery sergeant said, Lieutenant, he said, would you like a little advice? And I said, of course. And he said, if you'll always remember that motorcycle's a master of you, and you're not the master of it, well, then you'll be fine. It won't fall. And sure enough, I got a little cute one with it one day and felt it slipping out from under me. And those words came back to me, and I fortunately, I didn't hurt myself. But
right.
You learn to value these guys' experience, particularly when you're a young first lieutenant. If you don't, they will let you go ahead and make your mistakes the hard way. You know?
Right.
But once they see you're a good guy and you're receptive to their advice and you want their advice, well, then you've got a pretty good team.
Right. Besides taking care of your men, what other leadership skills did you learn there at the basic school?
Oh, I think probably just straightforwardness and honesty, you know, honesty in the matter of not stealing or something, but in the matter of just being straightforward with people and not trying to hide things or, and also to react pretty quickly to situations. I'm always amazed at how slow my wife reacts to things when I ask her to do something or something like that. I haven't been in the military, you know. I came out and this was actually a negative when I first got married because she brought a 10-year-old redheaded daughter into the marriage, and
mm-hmm.
Glenda had been working during the day and mm-hmm. going to school at night and dating on the weekends, and this redheaded 10-year-old daughter had pretty much had the run of her house, and I came in, you know, as a ex-Marine Corps lieutenant and,
right.
and saying my kids were going to do this and they're going to do this and this is the way they're going to behave and so forth. She made me eat every word. And but I'm always amazed at my wife at how slowly she reacts to things when I make a request of her. In fact, I have sort of this dream of having her in a precarious situation and yelling at her to do something quickly to solve it, and, you know, she's dragging her feet. So those things come from, you know, that's more judgment and being anal, I think, than
mm-hmm.
anything else.
Mm-hmm. Were they specifically trying to train you for, say, a Southeast Asia environment?
No.
Or was it just
No, because we didn't know we were in there, we were not going to be in there. At that time, we were just trained for conventional warfare. Then when we got over to Vietnam, there was a lot of training for guerrilla warfare and
mm-hmm.
unusual tactics. I remember in Vietnam, there was a 105 squadron that had all the planes parked down on the flight line. And one night, the VC broke through, and some of them had their tents out there, but I don't think anybody was killed. But the VC went through, and the next morning they went through and found grenades rolled into the tents by youngsters or kids or whatever, and the pins hadn't even been pulled. And that's my illustration of what a crazy war this was, you know, that you never really knew who the enemy was. You could go down to downtown Da Nang, be in a bar or something, and I've got pictures of the bars with metal work across them so somebody couldn't throw a Molotov cocktail or a grenade in the bar.
Right.
There was a lot less ways to terrorize people than there are now. And the Vietnamese very quickly adapted to that, and of course the Viet Cong pretty much stayed out in the field. If they were in the city, they weren't identified as Viet Cong. I mean, the VC, once you were out in the field, then you would expect the VC. You didn't expect them in the town, and there were a few instances of terrorism where they'd try to roll a grenade or throw a Molotov cocktail through a window in a bar where GIs were, you know, in town having a drink or something. But that was pretty rare.
Okay. When you think back at basic school, what do you see? What's your biggest memory of those 6 months?
I guess just the training and maybe the injury, because the injury was a lifelong thing, you know, with the cartilage.
Right.
I look back at it again. I had my captain, who was sort of our drill instructor, was a graduate of Annapolis, and his name was Tipsius.
Mm-hmm.
And it was obviously he was trying to climb the ladder, you know, and be. And he was quite an obnoxious guy. I mean, almost a little bit effeminate.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really in our platoon really respected him. Who was it? We had a big blonde-headed guy. He was a lieutenant. And after we graduated from basic school, they had this big cocktail party for you where, you know, the captain comes around and congratulates you on making it through and so forth. And this guy got pretty drunk and when Captain Tipsius came up to him to he said, "Captain Tipsius," he says, "you're the worst effing." And this guy came up from he came up from the ranks. He was in the enlisted corps and got nominated for an officer candidate corps.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "You're the worst effing officer I've ever served under." And he said, I think his name was Lindsey Telcher or something. He said, "Mr. Telcher, you're drunk." He says, "Yes, sir, Captain." He says, "I'm drunk." He says, "But I'll be sober tomorrow." And he says, "Tomorrow you'll still be the worst effing officer I've ever served under." And so this guy was really not respected by anybody. He was he tried to be over detailed. He had very few leadership qualities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just because he was an Annapolis graduate, he even kind of walked with a funny little feminine walk with his mm-hmm. pot belly sticking. He was just very unromantic and unmilitary, what you'd think of as being the. But I remember him.
Okay. So when did you graduate basic school? Do you remember?
Oh, boy.
62 or 63?
Well, I would have gone into my AOC in September for 6 weeks. It would have been probably the early part, I would say April or May. Yeah, it was in the springtime, so it would have been probably April or May of 1962. Is that right?
63.
63,
yeah. 63. Mm-hmm. Okay, and from there you went to...
From there I went to Cherry Point, North Carolina.
Okay.
And served, I'm sure I was there 6 months or maybe a year.
Mm-hmm. And that's... Tell me again exactly what you were doing there.
I was assigned to a fighter squadron. And did various duties around there, you know, they give me all the, because the pilots were busy flying, and so but I really didn't have too much to do, and I played a lot of golf there at Cherry Point. They had a nice golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I decided I was not going to be a backseat driver for the Phantom, the F-4,
mm-hmm.
I I think they transferred me to a Marine Air Support Squadron there.
Okay.
And that Marine Air Support Squadron was eventually transplaced to Cherry Point, North Carolina. MCAS, Marine Corps Air Station in Okinawa.
Okay.
At Fatima Air Force Base, Fatima was the Air Force Base, but Fatima was the town of Okinawa that we were, this is all pretty tough to bring up, and we were there for 6 months or so, 9 months, I think I had about 6 or 7 months left on my 3-year tour, so from 63 to December 65, so at some point we were ordered to go to Vietnam because the VC had started breaking through Da Nang.
Right. Okay, so from Cherry Point, you went over to Okinawa.
Yeah, we stopped at El Toro on the west coast, which is in near La Jolla.
Right.
And we were getting everything ready there, and then we went overseas, so we weren't there too long.
Okay. What was your unit assignment again in Okinawa?
Marine Air Support Squadron 2, which is the Marine Air Support Squadron of the 2nd Air Wing.
Okay.
And that's a DAS. In combat operations, that's a rounded bubble, kind of a fiberglass bubble that's probably, 30, 40 feet by 20 feet that's maybe 9 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the general's command post in combat. And the idea is that that all the status boards are in there where all the flights report in and out. We call that RIO, report in and out. And we launch medical evacs. We launch troop things. We talk to the artillery, blah, blah, blah. So any forward air control communications, forward air controller communications come in there and relayed, so
right.
The general theoretically knows what's going on.
Right. How did your family feel about you being overseas?
My mother did her share of crying, I think, when I left, as did my sister.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know too much. You'd probably have to ask her.
Okay. Bill, you want to take a break now for today?
Yeah, I think that might be good because I've got a couple of calls. I see if you just come in here. So,
okay.
I see we're back on for 8:30 on Wednesdays.
Correct. Yeah, we'll go ahead and end it today. This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. William Holmes. Today is April 28th, 2004. It's approximately 10:15 Central Standard Time. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, Texas Tech University Special Collections Library, and I'm in the interview room. And Mr. Holmes is again in Boulder, Colorado. Sir, why don't we pick up where we left off last time? You had reached Okinawa, and wanted you just to describe again what your duties were there and your unit, and was transitioned into Vietnam.
Okay. We were sent to Okinawa from Cherry Point. We went there via El Toro Marine Corps Air Station, which was on the west coast, and then were transported or transplaced or whatever you want to call it, over into Fatima, Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. Now Fatima, I'm sorry, there's another little town, and it's been a while, so
right.
I can't remember it. But
okay.
It was the Marine Corps Air Station on Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too far from Fatima Air Force Base. So there were several air strips there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we were transplaced down to Da Nang, and we went on huge LSTs. We had our particular Marine Air Support Squadron had a large fleet of vehicles and big what they call the 4x4 or 6x, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, my memory's really tough here, but full of equipment, radar equipment, communications equipment, because we were the direct air support center for the 2nd Marine Air Wing.
Right.
And basically that meant that we You know, we rode planes in and out and launched medevacs and stuff like that. So we were kind of a support unit, and we were when we got our stuff offloaded, we were located across the strip from the main control tower at Da Nang Air Force Base.
Bill, and let me ask you a couple of questions. When was this again, exactly?
Oh, boy.
1964?
No, this was in 1965.
Okay.
Let's see, I'm pretty sure. Because I was only in Vietnam. I was released from the service. Let me work back here. Mm-hmm. December 5th, 1965. I remember that date very well. And I was in Vietnam approximately 7 months. So we should have gone down there around probably in somewhere around May, June, July.
Okay.
Somewhere in that area.
Okay.
One reason I was confused here is that I, in the Marine training and basic school back in Quantico, mm-hmm. I tore the cartilage in my right medial meniscus, my leg, right leg. So during this transplantation, I had a chance to go back to Okinawa into a hospital there and get that fixed. So I was out about a month after going to Vietnam. I got to come back and get that fixed before I got out of the service.
Okay.
Long story short. Anyway,
okay.
So that's the reason some of my dates are kind of confused here.
Okay.
But
Bill, let me ask you real quick before we get into what you did tonight. Tell me what your first impressions were of Vietnam.
Well, you know, it's like any island or any when you come up on something in a ship and you see any piece of land, I mean, first of all, we'd been on LSTs, and LSTs are flat-bottom boats that put an anchor out in the harbor and then come up and run up on the beach and open the fronts of their bays and let all these vehicles out. That was what I was getting to. And the flat-bottom boats don't have a keel, so, you know, they're huge, huge ships. So we had some really rough seas, and boy, everybody in our group was very seasick going over. And I remember one time we have to go down and check all these vehicles that are chained down to in the tank deck in underneath the, inside the ship, and because they break loose sometime, and in rough seas they can really do some damage. And so I remember one night the top of the mast, if you can see, was actually going 60 degrees over to the horizontal, and I mean, this thing was really rocking and rolling, and I had already thrown up practically everything in my stomach, so I was going down very weak and trying to check these chains, and it was as I look back on it, it was humorous, but at the time it was absolute misery. But those are my non-combat woes. But anyway, so we. When you're on this ship and you come in, you're looking at land, and in fact, you know, we could see when we got closer the beautiful white beaches, and we sail right into a harbor, Da Nang Harbor, I guess. And I said Da Nang Air Force Base. I think it was just Da Nang Air Base or whatever. Mm-hmm. It wasn't although the Air Force was there, it wasn't. It was a large airstrip with a lot of different military services planes there. And so I don't know that my impression was any more than, good God, we're on land, thank goodness, and we get to be Marines again instead of naval people.
Right.
And so I think it was more relief than anything else. The one thing that did strike me about Vietnam is the beautiful white sand beaches. Mm. And I said that this is kind of interesting because something happened the other day here in our office, which makes this come true, but I said, you know, if they weren't fighting a war here, this would be a beautiful place for a resort and a five-star hotel and people to come to have wonderful vacations. And coincidentally enough, I'm in the investment business, but a fellow that I play some golf with that does some different types of investments has some friends with the upper in the real high echelons of the Vietnamese government now, Vietnam government, which North and South are now one. And he came over with a proposal for an investment to buy some beach property at Cameron Bay, which is up north of Saigon, or of Ho Chi Minh City now, Saigon then. And There's going to be a Disney theme park up very close to it. There, US 1, which is along the strip that runs from Saigon up to Natrang, instead of it being just a two-lane virtual street, it's going to be a six-lane highway.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, so some interesting things are happening in Vietnam. But when I was there, that was my impression, trying to, I guess, before I got into all the junk and combat and stuff that
mm-hmm.
we were got into, that
mm-hmm.
was my impression that, hey, this is a beautiful place. Then we get, I'll jump a little forward here.
Mm-hmm.
We got into September. We got into the monsoon season. I've forgotten how many inches they get a year, 30 or 60 inches a
mm-hmm.
year, usually within a few months. And then, of course, it wasn't quite as
right.
romantic as, because you're, I've got pictures, I think, some of the ones, the pictures I sent you of the foxholes that we had dug outside of our strongback tents and,
mm-hmm.
And that we lived in on the other side of the airstrip, and they're full of water, you know, they come
right.
in swimming pools.
Right.
So that was, my impression wasn't, I didn't particularly form a major impression other than this is a beautiful area.
Right. How did you feel mentally being in a war zone?
You know, I really don't remember. I guess when you're young, this is something I noticed about young troopers. I had a lot of them that were just couldn't wait to get into, you know, if they could go on a medevac or something where they could get close to the fighting. They'd seen the John Wayne movies. And my little story about that is that, you know, many of them just were raised early in their lives before it was color movies and
mm-hmm.
really going back, and so they didn't see that the blood was red, and then when some of them see some of their buddies coming out in body bags and or with significant injuries or stomachs open up and things like that, then it becomes much less romantic. But I think everybody wants to get into the fray, and I, as a second lieutenant, I was probably, I thought, you know, and as your impression too, when you go in a deal like this, if you're a U.S. Military, you see all the victories that the military has done, not disregarding the losses, but you think, oh boy, we're going to come in here and we're just going to kick ass and take names, and you know, that's going to be it. Well,
mm-hmm.
obviously Vietnam was not that type of thing. So I think everybody, and I'm speaking for myself when I'm trying to characterize this, comes into a war zone like that, you're clean, you've had plenty of showers, you've had plenty to eat, and whether you're in a combat unit or a support unit, you haven't really gotten into the hardships, particularly like in Iraq where they've got hot wind and sand and so forth and dust, and you hardly ever get really clean,
mm-hmm.
and you seldom get a really, really good meal. And so you come in with a very good, kind of a good positive gung-ho attitude, and I think most people keep some of that, but obviously once you're put under a lot of the hardships, I think that changes.
Right. What did you understand about why the United States was in Vietnam when you arrived, when you got there, or on the way over? What were they telling you? What did you think?
Well, they did quite a big propaganda campaign of how we were helping all these people, and you know, and the poor rice farmers and so forth were out there, and it was kind of the deal that they're going to welcome you into their cities with flowers, and you know, the same type of thing that a lot of the troops. Again, I make a lot of comparisons with Iraq here because. I think that was the impression of the people there, that we'd come in and we'd be hailed as the victors and rolling down the streets in our tanks, everybody sitting on top of the tanks. And,
right.
And of course, that would not have happened in Vietnam because it was a muddy type of, you know, it didn't have a lot of roads. But what I'm saying is the government did a very good job of pumping the troops up and giving them this wonderful feeling that we were going in and helping the people, and that we were kind of liberating them from this Viet Cong, which was this very insidious force that was there. And you know, some of that was very quite true. I mean, we treated the people very well as a general rule, unless, you know, we saw kids throwing hand grenades or something at us. And,
right.
And it was a very crazy war, as I mentioned to you. You could have, we were raised in a culture that told us that you know, our way was the only way, and I still say that we're deceived by our own deceit sometimes and thinking that everybody else thinks the same way we do. So we really went in there thinking that we were going to, you know, do all these wonderful things for Vietnam and get the communists out and the VC out, and of course they were quite motivated too, coming down from the north, and mm-hmm. and we didn't look at history and saw that the French, you know, I guess maybe you're a better history prof than I am, but I think there were not only the French, but there were several other countries or cultures came in there thinking they were going to change that country, and they were unsuccessful. So mm-hmm. I think this is a really good thing about history, that we, if some of our leaders were better historians, we might not be making the same mistakes that we're making even currently. Mm-hmm. But that's my own political that's my own opinion, not political, but just my own opinion on war.
Right.
It was a significant campaign from, you know, Westmoreland right on down, that we were in there to help the people, we were in there and so forth, and I understand that our first people that went in there were advisors, you know.
Yes.
And they weren't supposed to be combatants, and of course it was the tar baby effect, we just got pulled in, but they did a good job of making the troops and everybody feel like that we were accomplishing a good goal.
Mm-hmm. What was morale like?
I think morale was pretty good. Yeah, morale was pretty good. There was, and I wasn't in any of the infantry units. I don't know. I'm sure after you sit out there isolated, you know, with VC around you at a certain point, your morale may not be quite as good. But around my unit, it was very good.
Okay.
Everybody just kind of, you kind of get into a routine in a war zone where you feel like you're just doing your job.
Mm-hmm.
And then if some sudden hellish things happen or so forth, well, it kind of wakes you up to that situation. But most mm-hmm. of the time you're in there and you get, it's like anything else. Once you're there a few days and you get into a routine, you're doing your job and you're obeying your superiors and you're doing what they ask, and occasionally an order will come down that do something unusual, but you know it's a support function, so it's a job.
Right. Okay. Well, tell me about the first few days, about setting up quarters and things like that.
Boy, you know I'm really foggy on that. It's been
okay.
So long. Probably couldn't give you much. I know that we came back and the Corps of Engineers had come in and did strong backing for our tents, which is basically build a frame that you put your tents over. And we set up our direct air support center, which was a fiberglass sort of half bubble, looks like a half of an egg that sits on the ground, and with all the communications equipment. And I didn't have much to do with that. I was probably in logistics or something like that. So I had more to do with getting the stuff on the. I had wonderful NCOs. That did a lot of the work of diagramming how the equipment would go on the ship, and then when it got off the ship, you know, how it was offloaded and how it was mm-hmm. transported to the areas and how it was set up and so forth. So I really didn't have a whole lot to do with that, being honest with you.
Okay. Where did you all live? What were your quarters like?
We had strong back tents, and they were probably, I'm going to guess they were 12 to 14 man tents. Very large tents that were thrown over again a framing of 2x4s, so that they and then of course the tops were secured down as with tent lashes and tent pegs and so mm-hmm. forth. But it was we had a flooring in the bottom of our strong back tent, so it was pretty nice. I mean. Particularly compared to what the combat troops did.
Right.
So we had it pretty good. We were able to. We had a water buffalo outside, and we go outside and get water for there. It seems like to me there were showers somewhere, and we go to and just pretty normal stuff. Again, there's some pictures in there of my rack and my of the strong back tents in my field, so you could see what those look like.
Okay. And how many men were in your tents?
I think there were 12 to 14 officers in the tent that I was in.
Do you remember how you got along with everyone?
Yeah, we got along very well. I mean, we have a lot of downtime where you're just sitting around. We play a lot of poker, you know, and we'd go over to movies someplace. I don't know where we'd go over. Sometimes the Air Force Base would have movies, and sometimes we would have them within our compound. We would be able to go into Da Nang and go on liberty. All the rest of the different services were able to wear their utilities. The Marines had to dress in their khakis when they went in. So, you know, it was kind of a traditional thing. That always made me feel like it was a lot of BS. But
tell me about Da Nang. What was it like? What do you remember?
Probably not a city like you'd see in China, where they're just thousands and thousands of people running around like little ants. But more of just a little seaside city, a nice city, with good streets. The French had obviously done a pretty good job. Nice buildings, mostly stucco. The marketplace was a busy area with people with baskets on their heads and their bicycles and carrying things around and marketing all sorts of things to the GIs, just having all of things for the people, fish and vegetables and stuff like that. So a pretty normal, what most people would envision in their mind as a marketplace. A lot of very intelligent people there. A lot of people who were much smaller in stature than the U.S. Folks were, and yet some. Professors and doctors and so forth. So it had an integrated culture.
What did you think of the Vietnamese civilians in general?
I didn't get to know them extremely well because we didn't spend a lot of time in Da Nang. The ones that I knew in the military were just unbelievably loyal and committed to their cause, and that was the RVN, the Republic of Vietnam Army. Those guys were, I mean, they were tough little soldiers and very committed to their cause. Again, they probably had some pretty good lectures like we had. In town, the people, to me, they had that sort of the Asian cultural look combined with the French look. So the women were many of the women were quite beautiful. They dressed very attractively with long skirts and so forth. And because they had the French influence, many times a lot of these women had much longer legs. So they had the Asian olive complexion and the long black hair, and many of them had longer legs. There were a lot of them with shorter legs too. But I thought they were a very beautiful people and a very nice people too. I mean, I thought that I could see how we would come in and want to help these folks because they seemed like a very, in Spanish terms, simpatico group. They were very, very cordial. It would treat you very well, and so forth.
You talked about the ARVN troops briefly. What was your experience with the indigenous military forces of South Vietnam?
I really didn't have much experience with them except loading them on, watching them load on helicopters and go out for their missions. Never really fought beside any of them or did anything like that, so can't speak to that. I know the ARVN pilots, again, I have some pictures in my slide group that I sent to you of some of these little pilots that were quite proud, and I don't know what quality of pilot they were, my sense was that they weren't a big factor because they didn't have that many aircraft But we supported them quite well, maintenance-wise and parts and all that stuff. But they had some real old aircraft that was used in World War II. And some of those were very appropriate because they flew slower, and you know, you could, when you're shooting at people down in trees and so forth, you or dropping bombs, you probably want to be a slower deal. But I noticed there was a few planes there, but there weren't like squadrons and squadrons of them from my memory.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have that much close personal contact with any of them.
Okay. Can you describe, Bill, the Da Nang Air Base? What did it look like in your memory?
It looked like a regular military air base by the time we got there. It may have been an international airport at one point, but it became quickly a military air base with long strip, and most of the military units, including the artillery and so forth, were on. Let's see what that the ocean side would be the east side. So we were on the west side of the airstrip. If it runs north and south, I'm assuming that.
Mm-hmm.
And all the permanent facilities were on the other side, the east side of the airstrip. So, I'm not sure that it ran north and south, but that's my orientation. And again, I have some pictures of the airstrip and the air base taken from the air when I got some jet rides there. So that might be interesting to you. I may have even had one of my friends take the camera up and shoot some pictures of the air base from here.
Right.
It wasn't too far from the harbor, so you can kind of get a concept of what it looks like by those pictures.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you had enough supplies and things there at base that you needed?
Reasonably so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. We were pretty well supplied.
Okay. What about food?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were okay. I mean, we had a chow line set up and so forth that we went to, and we weren't on, as I remember, we weren't on sea rations and so forth. And I remember going on R&R to Hong Kong for about a weekend, and the first thing I did is go into the bar, and I said, I want 3 glasses of fresh milk. I loved milk at that time. I don't drink anymore. But we had powdered milk, and, you know, I mean, but those things which people today hearing this might turn up their noses at once you get into a situation like that, you know, you get quite used to dried food and things that aren't quite the way we eat here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. What was your typical day like? What did you do?
Boy, I'm trying to remember that. I think we'd have shifts in the Direct Air Support Center, the DASC, and we'd get up in the morning, and, you know, we might have an afternoon shift or an evening shift. Sometimes we'd throw the ball around, play a little baseball. A lot of reading. Other than the duties in the Director Support Center, and I can't remember how long those shifts were. It seems like they might have been 6 hours or something like that. That was pretty much what we were there for. There was another thing we did, and that was some radar bombing, which was they had a, at that time they thought it was a very sophisticated little container that had all this electronic gear in it that you would sit in with a radar operator, and through the use of triangulation with the plane and the your point there in that little container, the target being 3 points. This particular computer was supposed to, it was one of the early computers, and it had a huge amount of electronic gear, and it was very seldom operating correctly. I jokingly say I don't think we ever killed anybody, but by triangulation it would lock on the plane and do the triangulation between the plane, the target, and the radar location that we were sitting at. And what we would do is we would, at 10,000 feet, we would talk a plane into a certain area and tell them when to drop their bombs. So it could have been a very effective bombing device with a plane at 10,000 feet, and you think it's not even near you, and all of a sudden bombs are going off around you for the VC.
Mm-hmm.
The problems are, and we would sit with a little needle, kind of sit there between our legs with this little needle going back and forth, and the zero line was the target line, and we would tell the pilot he's turn 2 degrees left or turn 2 degrees right, and then we would say stand by to release your bombs, and then we'd give him a mark, and so he would hear. So he had two times in case there were any radio problems, but mm-hmm. we would guide him in to a certain flight path and have him on that path at a certain altitude.
Mm-hmm.
The trajectory of the bombs had been figured and so forth. So theoretically, it was supposed to be a very high-tech way of dropping bombs from an altitude on unsuspecting groups when they
mm-hmm.
were called in.
It sounds like, in a sense, you all serve as the laser that is now used in laser-guided bombs, where they're the
ones to a certain extent, but boy, that was real. As I look back on it, it was very primitive. And,
okay.
and like I say, the unit was always down. I mean, they were always, the poor technicians were working on this thing all the time, and it was probably one of those things that had to be a precursor for the things that we have now, but it was just it was pretty archaic. I really would be surprised if we ever hurt anybody with it.
How effective were your efforts in doing that?
Well, again, I don't know. I don't think we never got back any reports that we hit a VC unit
mm-hmm.
or something like that. But my thoughts are that it was an area bombing device, not a pinpoint bombing device.
Right.
So I just don't know.
Okay.
I'd prefer to think we never hurt anybody after being back out, but
right.
that's not very military. But anyway.
Okay, so that's one major thing you all did. Are there any other duties that you remember?
No, that was pretty much it.
That was it. Sounds like you had a lot of downtime.
Yeah, we did, and we would go over from time to time. We were real close to the helicopter units,
mm-hmm.
which were the Hueys, HU-1E or something, and we'd go on. Sometimes we'd jump on there with a crew chief and go on a medical evac, and I've got some pictures of that too in the slides. And or we'd go into an LZ, a landing zone, and just go on the trip itself, particularly if it wasn't a major combat operation or something where we never catch a lot of fire. But never went on any of the patrol boats or anything like that. Never even really got close to that type
mm-hmm.
of action.
Okay. What do you remember the relationship between officers and the enlisted?
I think they were very good. I think we had a group of officers, and this is true, I think, in the Marine Corps. I think the Marine Corps, they educate you very quickly that,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're tied to your men and your success and your life, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you take really good care of them in the Marine Corps. I think our officers were our NCOs. We had really good NCOs, people who had been around the Marine Corps a long time and knew how to handle the troops and were probably a hell of a lot better leaders than the young lieutenants, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a lot of fun with them. I mean, we were there with them. It wasn't like it was you're separated from us, although in the military there is that sort of status separation. But once you get over there in a unit like that, you know, I mean, I've got one picture, for example, I don't know why this sticks out in my mind, of somehow down in one of the marketplaces, something, one of the guys came back with a little puppy dog, and we all just, you know, I mean, of course, we all just went crazy over the little dog, and he was a little puppy, and so he was doing all sorts of cute things. So that was a nice distraction, and
mm-hmm.
and he uncovered, the little puppy uncovered a mice den, and I've got some pictures there of all these little baby mice that have just been hatched in a dustpan, you know. And yeah, goofy things like that stick out in your mind. I don't remember too much of the...
Right.
There was a lot of artillery shelling, so, you know, sometimes it was a little tough to sleep at night if you were... But you get used to all that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, your body really acclimates to that.
Tell me about that. How often was the base shelled?
Well, our base wasn't shelled. I didn't mean that. But okay. next door to us was a 105 artillery unit,
right,
that was shelling up in the hills, and you know, anytime.
And, mm-hmm,
you know, they have huge ranges, so they could be shelling a mile off or something like that.
So you guys didn't get mortared?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, we never did.
Okay.
There were a few times that the VC did come through the base and made attacks, maybe a couple times they made attacks on them. And I've got pictures, too, of when they hit a 105 squadron, which the planes were parked out on the airstrip, way out, you know. And that's what I was telling you about earlier, where they had some tents out there for crew chiefs. I'm not sure the pilots. I guess the pilots probably did. And they probably slept over at the Air Force base, but this was an Air Force unit. And one night the VC broke in and they destroyed a couple of planes, and that was where I told you they were rolling grenades in the
mm-hmm.
tents. And the next morning they found a bunch of grenades without the pins even pulled. So it just kind of illustrates the,
mm-hmm.
the craziness. But that was the only really. The word I want for the penetration of the air base. We did go over there because they had broken into the air base a couple times. That was the reason our unit, this whole Marine 2nd Division and Air Wing was sent in there.
Okay.
I believe that's the reason.
Okay. Did you ever hear of any incidents of fragging or real problems between enlisted and officers?
No.
Okay.
I mean, when you're going through it, you hear deals where, you know, lieutenants were shot in the back in combat because they weren't, you know. But I think that's more of a, I think that's more of a situation where it may have happened a few times in World War II or something where somebody, you know, I mean, people get under stress in combat or maybe some troops felt like that this guy was going to do them more harm than good, you know, as far as looking out for them.
Right.
But I never heard of that, and maybe it did happen over there, but I certainly didn't hear of it.
Okay. You're someone who stayed in the rear and part of the very, very important support structure. Did you ever come across anybody who was out in the front lines?
Yeah, I think we talk with guys all the time that would come back, you know, or come back on a medevac or so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they didn't really talk a lot about what went on.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that was?
I'm not sure. I guess they just wanted to get away from it.
Right. You're talking about the medevac helicopters?
Yeah, I guess. I'm trying to think of a case where somebody came back and told me a long story of what had gone on out in the bush, but I really can't remember any of that. I can't
mm-hmm.
remember that happening. Maybe it did, and it's been too long or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Talk to me about what your opinions were of the Viet Cong and the NVA and what you were told, what you heard, and what do you think about it?
Well, you would hear that they might be a farmer out, you know, in a rice paddy
mm-hmm.
by day, and then they put on the black pajamas at night. I mean, they painted a rather not austere, but they painted a rather deceptive type of person, because I think they wanted the military wanted you to be on alert all the time. But I just remember, I guess the biggest impression I have of them with respect to the war was the fact that they that they could be somebody who smiled at you and so forth at one instant and stick a knife in your back in the next.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm back off from that, I probably know that was a little bit different, that the VC probably were more organized than that. They may have had a few terrorists, so to speak, that come in town and infiltrate occasionally and do a few little goofy things, but They pretty much were out in real estate, trying to control real estate or take over real estate or, you know, get the Americans out or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was a more organized type of thing than I guess in my mind it was when I was over there.
Right. Okay. Yourself, did you have to carry a sidearm or anything like that?
Yeah, I carried a .45.
Okay.
And, again, one of the pictures shows me wearing it with a shoulder holster, and, mm-hmm. you know, or with your utilities, your fatigue. So.
Did you wear that when you went into Da Nang?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I don't think so. I don't remember taking a sidearm in Da Nang. I'm not sure they would let you do that. No, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't let you go on liberty with your sidearm.
Right. Bill, what was your standard uniform then, like, day-to-day?
Just green utilities.
Mm-hmm.
Again, pictures of that are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much it. There was no camouflage. Later on, they did camouflage things, I think, and I came back with a camouflage flight suit, which was used over there a little bit more, which looked more like the green, you know, dark green camouflaging, but we never wore those around the night.
Okay. How would you rate American intelligence and American communication there that you witnessed in Da Nang in 1965?
American intelligence. I don't know. Probably not in a real good position to comment on.
Okay.
I would imagine on a scale of 1 to 10, I would imagine our intelligence was probably 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that?
I'm just not sure we knew what was going on. Again, my bias, and this is a bias, that was that there was more of a propaganda machine going on with the officers and troops from Westmoreland and the Defense Department on down than there was just genuine stuff coming through.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure tactically, as far as the intelligence was concerned, they had, maybe it was a 7, I don't know, I just didn't, I think if they had really good intelligence, and again, it's hard to have that when all the VC are coming from the north down mm-hmm. into an area, and you don't have anybody located up there, I wouldn't think.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you do, very few, and can they speak English, or can they not speak? Maybe I've got a very limited view of all this,
mm-hmm.
but I think if our intelligence were very good, well, then we wouldn't have had some of the massacres that we had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's reading another for my rating. Well, you said intelligence and what else?
In communication. Just how do you think the Americans, from what you witnessed, communicated amongst yourselves and then with folks out in the field and the pilots, et cetera?
Well, I think communication was reasonably good. As far as radio and all that stuff, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think it's excellent.
Okay.
That's what we were, was a communication unit,
yes.
Basically, to be the eyes and ears of the commander of the air wing.
Mm-hmm. What was your relationship with the pilots? Did you frequent with them very much?
Not very much, no. No, we'd go into, occasionally go into a bar and see some, or some would come by the unit or something like that,
mm-hmm.
but there wasn't a lot of, and we had pilots in our units, you see.
Right.
Yeah, we had a guy named Jeffrey Heller, who is Ross Perot's pretty much second in command at EDS right now, or was for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He retired, now he's come back, and I think he even lives here in Colorado. I need to look him up. But he was an A-4 pilot, and I think he had a mid-air collision or something with another fighter, and he ejected out. That was an interesting story. But we had a couple of pilots in that 14-man tent area. We probably had one or two pilots there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but
that's the only communication we really had. I mean, we would see them occasionally when we'd go into the division headquarters and go into the bar or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked about your downtime and some of your entertainment, playing poker, things like that. What else did you all do to pass the time?
That's about all I can remember, to be honest with you. I mean, between reading and throwing the ball around, and it was very hot there in the summer, and we were there right in the middle of the summer. See, I always was in Vietnam for like, 6 or 7 months or something like that, counting the time I went to Okinawa to get my knee fixed. And so I guess in that respect I was very fortunate. But when it's 120, 130 degrees out on the airstrip, you're not out doing a whole lot of things. You're lying in your rack just hoping to breathe, trying to find a fan somewhere and stay cool.
What about keeping up with folks back at home? Did you write letters?
Yeah, I wrote letters, and I did. I had a little tape machine that I did, and we used to have a lot of tapes and things like that. And I think I may have tossed those at one point. I got tired of all of them. This was before I found out about what you folks do. And but I wrote letters, and in fact, I think I passed some letters, some of those letters on to you there for your archive. So I think that's in the stuff I sent.
Okay,
but. They were letters, you know, basically. It was interesting. I would, one time I looked over, one of my, he was just a, he was a truck driver, you know, or something like that in our, in the MASH unit that we had. And from Okinawa, this is before we ever went to Vietnam, I looked over his, shoulder one time. I couldn't help but notice. And he was writing this letter to his girlfriend, and he said, you know, he says, life here is measured in seconds. He was really, and this is what happens to a lot of the young kids when they go over there. You know, they haven't had much, or at that time they hadn't had much experience with relationships with a lot of, so a lot of them tried to magnify it, a lot of them tried to play it down, you know, so you saw all different types of letters, but I thought that was pretty funny. And, and of course, when we were in Okinawa, and this is backtracking a little bit, I found it interesting that the Okinawan women, particularly the gals in the bars and so forth, would latch on to a certain young enlisted person, GI, this wasn't totally exclusive to enlisted, but happened more with them than not because they were younger. They'd latch on to one, and they just make them feel like they were the only guy in the world, you know. And a lot of these young guys, their hormones were raging, so they were, you know, they would come to you, I'm in love, I want to marry this gal. Then you'd have to talk to them and say, you know, now wait a minute, you know, make sure you know what you're doing here, and let's talk about this a little bit. And what's going to happen when these situations happen, or when you leave, and blah, blah, blah. But they, occasionally these guys would take these little gals into the PX, which was, to them, I mean, like taking somebody from a slum into Neiman Marcus or something like that. And so we used to kid them, the troops, a lot of these gals, and not all of them were bar girls, some of them were just young women in the town, but they would see you as a ticket back to the land of the big PX, because that's the way they viewed the U.S.
Right.
And so when you ask about I forgot what your last question was. It was about
just about the I was asking in general about entertainment and about downtime and and you started talking about Okinawa.
Okay. Well, but the downtime, you know, we all had it, and a lot of times, most everybody had a job that they did. You know, whether it was some type of maintenance or some type of technical or communication or keeping the communication gear up, or you know, all the logistics of supporting a military unit.
Did music play a role in your life over there?
Yeah, I can remember guys having tapes and things over there, and in the tent that we were talking about. Yeah, a few guys had tape players, and I don't remember much about the radio, where there were radio stations. I'm sure I remember a movie made about that with Robin Williams, but Good Morning Vietnam. But I I don't remember a lot of radio stations that we could tune into, so I don't know that I ever heard a radio station without
them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Were you ever to make, able to make any Mars phone calls?
I may have made one or two from Okinawa. I don't remember ever making any from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No.
Okay. On base, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I could be wrong about that, but I don't remember.
Okay. On base there at Da Nang, were there facilities for religious services that you could attend?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you do so?
I mean, well, they'd have them pretty much out in the field. I mean, again, we were in such hot climate that they'd have a tent or someplace that you could go, or, you know, every unit had its chaplain, which were attempted to be non-denominational, they could do. But as far as I remember, there was, you could get, on Sunday, you could get in a truck, ride a truck over to some place where they would have services.
Would you go?
Occasionally. Not every time, I don't think. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot depends on the weather, what shift you were on. You know, if you were on a midnight till 6 o'clock shift the next morning, you probably were seeing sleeping in. So, you know, war is kind of a full time deal. It's not, you're not on a regular schedule.
Mm-hmm. So. Right.
Different deal.
What about the drug and alcohol use? Did you witness any of
that? You know, I really, and I'm being very candid with you, I never mm-hmm. witnessed any of that. And maybe I was there too early. I got out of there in December 65.
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw any of that. When I hear about that, I shake my head because I don't remember seeing any of that or being near it or having any problems with the kids. Probably had more problems with the kids the enlisted people and my people under my command with venereal disease and making sure they didn't get, gonorrhea or something like that. Versus drugs and alcohol. We had one guy, I think, in the squadron that drank a little too much, but that would be about it, I think.
Okay.
Pretty strange.
You mentioned going on R&R to Hong Kong. What was that like?
Heaven. Got on a plane and landed at this airport that when you go into Hong Kong from a place like that, it really doesn't look that much there, but it looks like New York City because there's all these high-rise buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And you're landing on out on, I believe the landing strip was out on the, was built out into the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you come in, they make the circle around all these huge, very tall buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not skyscrapers, but they're, they're 20 stories, 40, 50 stories. And maybe not 50, but anyway, you come in and you come through all this, and man, it just looks like you're back, almost back in the U.S.
Right.
So that was nice, and I landed, and like I say, the first thing when I got up, I went down to a bar and got three. I checked into the Hong Kong Hilton, and again, I got some pictures of that, and
mm-hmm.
I actually brought back a. One of the books from the Hong Kong Hilton that they give everybody that stays there.
Yes.
And it's a thick book, about an inch thick, a half an inch thick, and it's got colored pictures of course, it's supported by all the different merchants that want everybody to shop with them. But I remember it being wonderful to just sleep in sheets and under air conditioning, and I believe there was air conditioning there. And
mm-hmm.
And I don't really remember what I did, except during the days I went out and did a lot of shopping, bought a lot of beaded cashmere sweaters and
mm-hmm.
pearls for my mother and my my sister and my grandmothers. And at the time, of course, I wasn't married. But anyway, that was what I did mostly there.
How long did that last?
I don't remember exactly. I think it was about 2 or 3 days.
Okay. And did it really help you?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it gives you a taste of reality again. You get
mm-hmm.
you get a different routine. And also, I remember trying to, I don't know whether I did this or not, but there was a bus you could take and go up to a certain observation point and look into China.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at Kowloon. And I don't think I ever did that, but I think I kind of regretted not having done that, But, of course, Hong Kong is in China, but this was where the the border, the boundary was between the British, at that time British controlled Hong Kong and Kowloon, which I think was over on the China
mm-hmm.
side.
Mm-hmm. Were you by yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't go, I don't remember going with anybody else.
Okay. Tell me about back at Da Nang, USO shows. Did you have access to any of those?
I don't remember ever going to a USO show, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Maybe, again, that's gone from my mind, but I don't remember going to any USO shows.
Okay. Let's talk about the relationships within your unit. Were there any racial tensions, anything like that, that you remember?
No, I really don't remember anything like that. And I think we were predominantly white. We may have had a couple of African Americans in our, and one or two Hispanics. But I think that, no, I think our unit was kind of interesting in that I don't remember anybody in our unit being real intense. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Except our commanding officer. And he was kind of a an interesting guy. I think his name was Cunningham or something. Major Cunningham. And he was a by-the-book guy and real stickler for details and so forth. And but a fair one, you know what I mean? He seemed to, I think he did a pretty good job. What he had and what his job was.
The other men in the unit, you said you all got along well?
Yeah, I think we got along very well. I think we tried to have fun. Again, the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, the gunnery sergeants, and anybody from E5 on up seemed to kind of be the glue that held the unit together, and they would keep things fun, or, you know, I mean, they did their jobs, obviously, very well, but they seemed to keep things reasonably pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As pleasant as it can be in that type of situation.
Okay. Do you remember any particularly humorous incidents or using humor to help the situation?
I'm sure there were some, but I can't recall a lot of them right now. The ones I remember I pretty much already told you. You know, I'm sure there were a ton of humorous deals that we did over there, but I'm having a hard time bringing up anything.
Right. Okay. Bill, how anxious were you to leave Vietnam? Was it a 6 or 7 months that went by fast and you're ready to get out, or was it something that just another routine assignment for you?
Well, it certainly wasn't a routine assignment, but I was blessed by the fact that I had already spent almost 4 years in the Marine Corps, including my time in the active reserve there
yes.
at Texas Tech, and so I was ready to get out. I knew that I did not want to make a career of the Marine Corps. I always felt like the Marine Corps was a little too focused on tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that we couldn't wear our utilities into town when everybody else could, you know, things like that. The Marine Corps just does a lot of things where they're very, and I understand when you're dealing with young people, age 20 to 35 or whatever, that you've got to have some structure and you've got to have some real major discipline. And I think it'd be good for all of our kids to have to go through boot camp for 6 weeks. Why not? Just appreciate, learning to do things when they should and so forth. But I was definitely ready to get out. I mean, when you're in the military, you count down those days. I mean, you've got a calendar and you get down to a point where you call, people start calling you short, remember you're so short that you can walk under the door and all that stuff.
Right.
But when you get down with the last few weeks or days, and unlike some of the combat troops where it really gets critical, I had a good friend who was a helicopter pilot. I don't know whether this has anything to do with what I'm talking about, but he had been over there for 9 months or 10 months and had never been shot down, never been I don't think he'd been hit very much, maybe a few little rounds or something, and taking guys in and out of landing zones. And crew chiefs, he told me crew chiefs, either really wanted to be on his plane or didn't, or wanted to stay away from it,
mm-hmm.
because they knew that they either thought that he was very blessed or that the law of averages was going to catch up with him. You know?
Right.
And the big fear is that you're a week from the time you go home and then you get both legs shot off or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real tragedy. So when you get down to those last few weeks, that last month, and start counting it down, it's really it doesn't make any difference whether you're in a support unit or a combat unit or
mm-hmm.
whatever. You just can't, the time can't pass fast enough.
And that's how you felt?
Yeah, I think I did, because I was anxious to get out, get my life started, and get back home.
Did they try to talk you into staying in the Marine Corps?
They always try to give you reenlistment options. I don't think the officers, they do it as much as they do the enlisted. But they'll come out the enlisted, and they'll offer them huge bonuses. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, $4,000 or $5,000, and you know, depending on what your rank is and what your experience is and what the MOS is, you need, if they need that particular military occupational specialty, they'll really try to keep those guys in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I could have re-upped, but I didn't see much pressure. No, didn't see much pressure to do that at all, particularly in the officer area.
Did you change your activities, your day-to-day activities, as you got shorter?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-mm. Okay.
No, I don't. I don't believe that change. You still do your job. You still do what you, you know, whatever's required of you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bill, why don't we stop for today?
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Bill Holmes. Today is May 11th, 2004. It's 9:32 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, and Bill is again in Boulder, Colorado. Sir, let's start with where we left off from our last conversation. You were leaving Vietnam, and I'd like for you to kind of describe again the circumstances under which you did so and your feelings on leaving this war zone.
I think that I was kind of a little bit of an unusual situation, and then I didn't have a full tour in Vietnam. I was there, it's hard for me to remember the exact dates, but probably 6 to 8 months
mm-hmm.
On the very end of my three-year tour, three-year active duty tour. I had
yes.
some time before that. But so I was pretty fortunate, and I didn't have to spend a whole year over there. The Marine Corps tours are normally, I think, 13 months.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Marine Corps, whenever they go overseas, they go with totally without any dependents as opposed to some of the other services. So I can remember somewhere around December 5th, 1965, was it? Yeah. Being a great day because, and of course, in the military, you look forward to you're what they call getting short
mm-hmm.
when you're, and you're looking forward to getting out of there because you know they're obviously more pleasant places and family and so forth to be. So,
yes.
I can remember crawling on that big. I think it was a C-130.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, maybe out of Vietnam, it was more of a traditional type of airliner that was contracted with the government to take us out of there. And
mm-hmm.
I think they took us to Guam or Hawaii, and maybe we changed planes there. It's hard for me to remember. It's been so long ago.
Right.
But anyway, that was look forward to as a great day. So. Anytime you leave a place like that, you're pretty happy. That's
mm-hmm.
probably one of the happiest days of your life. And I said that Christmas that I had in 1965 with my folks was probably one of the best, most valued Christmases because First of all, I had ordered a little P18 Volvo to be waiting for me in San Francisco, and I was going to pick that up and drive back to Texas. So enjoy this little sports car all the way back, and totally different lifestyle without all the demands of military service. So I was released from the service in San Francisco at Treasure Island.
Bill, let me interrupt just for a moment. Do you remember the flight back as far as how you felt and the mood on the plane or planes?
No, I don't remember the food on the plane.
The mood on the plane.
Sir. Not really. I have one story that will stick in my mind as long as I live, and that was I was sitting next to a private first class, or something. I think he had one stripe, from the Army, and I could tell by the patch on his sleeve that he was from the 1st Infantry Division, and I remembered that they had some people totally overrun by the VC at a place called Dong Zoi, and I never will forget, we came over the Golden Gate Bridge in preparation to land whatever Air Force Base was there in San Francisco, and they tilted the plane over so that we could see the Golden Gate Bridge, because that was our first image of the U.S. I mean, we didn't see Catalina or anything, but Catalina's further south. But that was our first image of the U.S., and he was a little African-American private, and the tears welled up in his eyes. And it's hard for me to tell the story without getting pretty emotional, but I remember looking over to him, and I remember he had told me how he had been in this foxhole at Dong Zoi when the VC hit, and he was in there with a buddy of his who'd been killed, and he was with his dead friend for, I guess, I don't know, 18 hours or 12 hours or maybe 20 hours, I don't remember the time frame, but a long time, not knowing where he's going to live or die and whether they're going to be rescued or not, and fortunately he did get out, but he lost his buddy, and I looked over at him, I saw him, the tears well up, and I said, Private, does that look pretty good to you? And he says, yes, Lieutenant, he says, about 3-4 weeks ago, he says, I didn't ever think I was going to see this place again. The mood when you get back into the States is really incredible. I remember I went went into a restaurant, and I sat down, and I had something like a milkshake, because we hadn't had, you know, anything but powdered milk for a while, or some type of meal. And anyway, I remember sitting behind or across from a couple that was arguing about something that was so menial. I mean, it was the color of her dress or something, and your whole sense of values really becomes concentrated or really appreciated the small things in life, and you sit there and wonder, you know, these people are sitting there eating a wonderful meal. They don't have any issues of security. They should be pretty happy. They've probably got plenty of money, and they're arguing over this thing. And so you're transformed from an atmosphere where a lot of things seem very valuable: home, family, companionship of your friends, family, loved ones, and so forth, into an atmosphere where many of those things don't seem to be appreciated.
Right.
And I guess that's the one thing that stuck with me. And for that reason, I've always thought that it would be nice to have all of our kids, certainly not go through a war, but go through some type of military training where they were suffering some type of hardships, or everybody should have to, where they come back into the world where they're much more appreciative of something to eat, and they're not worried about eating broccoli or cauliflower.
Right.
I was just saying that I think somehow in a wonderful utopian world that we would be able to train all of our people, young people or children, whatever, somehow to have a period in their life of some type of hardship or scarcity, where when they come back into the type of world we have, where it seems like most ever all of us have everything we really want or need, maybe not want, but certainly need, and mm-hmm. we have plenty to eat, clothing, plenty of water, and things. It would really make them appreciate the things that we do have in this country, and what a rich lifestyle and what an incredible standard of living that we have here. So that was the one impression, I guess, that I left with, is that, you know, we really don't appreciate the things we have. And I think everybody that comes back from a war zone or even the military mm-hmm. in a country that's impoverished has that sort of appreciation they've seen. And for that reason, of course, being real philosophical here, travel does broaden us and our kids and lets them know there's other things besides video games and
right.
those type of things.
Too. Right. Were you in uniform when you came back in?
Yes, I was. Yeah, everybody comes back in uniform.
Right. Yeah. Well, tell me, of course, this is in December 65, so the controversy really hasn't begun to boil up, but what was your reception like at the airport and your travels back across the country to Texas?
Well, certainly I was not in uniform going back across
right.
the country, and, you know, I wouldn't advertising the fact that I just got out of a dorm. Maybe I told a few people to stop. I don't remember any positive or negative reactions there. Again, it's been so long, I probably would have stored those back in my, I mean, I would put them away if they'd been negative, but unless they'd been extremely negative, but mm-hmm. I don't remember any positive or negative things there.
Okay. So you didn't experience anything at the airport in San Francisco?
No, it was
okay.
a military airport, so, you know, they welcomed us back. There was no there was no banners and bands.
right. What was your transition to civilian life like? Was it difficult for you? And how much, tell me about your discussions about Vietnam with your family.
Boy, you know, my mother could probably answer that question better than I could. There's some things in the with respect there she remembers a lot better than I do
mm-hmm.
because it was, I won't say more meaningful to her, but more emotional to her than me. But
sure.
I don't remember. I guess the one thing I remember is when I came back, when I left, my little sister was a kind of a pesty little, you know, girl. She was 10 years younger than I, and she always wanted to go with me and my friends and do things when we were... And when I got back, she had grown into a young woman, and I was really amazed at that how extreme that transition had been.
Right.
And that was really about all I can remember. I'm sure that everybody was, my mother and my father were very happy to have me back, and I don't remember the for example, the newspaper coming out and interviewing me or anything like that. So
right.
I did have, I think, in my the memorabilia that I sent you, that there was one article about that I wrote where I talked about the winds or something in Vietnam. I don't know what it was, so
mm-hmm.
you know, I might refer to that. But I that might refresh some of my memory. But I sent all that to you. So,
right.
But anyway, that's it.
Okay. Tell me about your thoughts about the continuing war. I mean, how much did you keep up with it? Obviously, it exploded after you came back.
You know, I really didn't. I kind of enjoyed the being aloof from it
mm-hmm.
as much as I can remember. I don't remember involving myself one way or the other. I just was happy to be out of there.
Okay.
And so maybe I was a little in denial or numb or whatever from it. But,
So you did keep up with it, but on the fringe?
I probably read some stuff about it in the newspaper, but I didn't get a map and you know,
right.
follow the progress at all.
What did you think of the overall U.S. strategy and policy in Southeast Asia?
Well, again, I think I've mentioned this before. When you're there, you're pretty much, there's a lot of, I won't say brainwashing, but a lot of propaganda to make you feel like that you're doing the right thing and that you're helping a lot of people and so forth, and I'm
mm-hmm.
sure we did.
Mm-hmm.
As I became older, though, I realized that very similar to what I feel today is that our leaders, you know, it's the old deal that the old men declare the wars and the young men fight them or whatever. There's got to be a saying about that somewhere. But I think the politics and the after I found out later on what was going on, I was pretty sickened by seeing all the poor decisions and I guess I would say really lack of integrity among our leaders and so forth because they were playing, you know, the international politics game.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the idea of Vietnamization, turning over the war to the Vietnamese? Did you think that was viable?
You know, I'll be honest with you, I don't even remember having an opinion on it.
Okay.
And I may have, but that's been 40 years ago. So
right.
It's hard for me to... I don't know whether I've kind of consciously blocked a lot of that stuff out or whether maybe after that I just didn't really care. It wasn't part of my life. Maybe I'm too selfish. Maybe I wanted to get on with my career. Maybe, you know, so many other things that were running through my mind that were much more important to me at the time.
Mm-hmm. What about April 1975? Do you remember that when South Vietnam fell? What were your thoughts and feelings?
Vaguely, but I don't remember my emotions surrounding that, to be candid.
Okay. Well, how do you feel about it now, today?
Well, it's kind of funny. Maybe did I mention to this that a fellow brought by a prospectus and on a land deal that he's doing, where he's in somehow with some folks that are in the hierarchy of the government. I guess it's still a bit of a communist government, but
mm-hmm.
They're trying to develop the tourism to Vietnam, which I always said would be a beautiful place, they're selling property on the beaches and so forth. They're going to build 5-star hotels. Disney's going to go in there and put a theme park in. There's going to be a large airport. US-1, which goes up and down the thing, is going to be improved from a 2-lane road to a 6-lane highway. So, I guess I'm, you know, one of the things I've always tried to do is stay, is accept change. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people hold grudges and things. If we could just accept the change that happens in the world, we'd be better off, as well as respecting the diversity and different ideas of our neighbors. But I don't really have any, except for the fact of seeing that the way we went into the Iraq and the way we plunged into there and thought we were gonna, our political leaders will tell you, no, it's different from Vietnam. It is exactly like Vietnam. I mean, it couldn't be any, but it's the tar baby effect. Once you get in, involved in there, well, then you're stuck and you've already made a commitment. You've spent all this money and, resources and lives, of course, which are the most important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I become, and this is strange for a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps, become much more of a total pacifist, but recognizing that the world's going to has a lot different ideas about how to conduct themselves, different religions and so forth than we do, and when we stir that bucket, it's like stirring a bucket of bees. I mean, you're going to get stung.
So
I'm not sure exactly what the right answer is, but I think we took a very poor course, and I can see this. So that's the thing that sticks with me in answer to your question.
Okay. Do you think the United States learned lessons from its experience in Vietnam?
Well, I'm afraid they didn't. I guess it's been long enough that the young folks who were actually fighting the war probably weren't even around then or were babies then. So They certainly didn't remember the history of it, and it's sad that our leaders, who are 50, 60 years old in Congress and our leadership, didn't realize it.
Right. Well, how do you feel about your service in Vietnam today? I mean, you kind of addressed that already, but just are there specifics that you think about, or is there?
Well, I think my military service was a positive thing in my life. I think I may have mentioned a friend of mine back in school who went in the reserves for 6 weeks and then was in active duty for 6 weeks and then was in the reserve for X number of years and came out and said I wouldn't go through it again for less than X million dollars. And I certainly wouldn't want to repeat it, but I think it was a character-building experience in the military because it developed discipline, structure, organization, those qualities in my life. But it also gave me a sense of values to think for myself and recognize that our leaders aren't always correct and that they can make mistakes so that this fierce nationalistic feeling of whatever track the U.S. decides to go on, that everybody should just line up like little baby ducks and follow the mother, which is what the mentality that you have to get in the military is once you get out of the military, you need to understand that there's good judgment and that you have the ability to exercise that. And so I guess that's the thing that I take from the military service. As far as being in Vietnam, sure, it was a character-building experience. You can't go over there and see people wounded and killed and hauled out in body bags without growing up probably a lot faster than you would if you were just simply back home running a business. But I guess that would be my overall general impression.
Okay. Is there anything that you would change about your Vietnam experience, if you could?
I don't know. I guess in an ideal world, I probably would have more enjoyed being a pilot over there than controlling aircraft. That's kind of from a mechanical standpoint. Anything I would change. You know, I met a lot of nice people. I met a lot of great guys. One or two I've kept up with. No, I don't think. I don't know anything that I could have changed. Being practical,
right.
In an ideal world, sure. I'm sure there are things that I would have changed. You know, I had a lot of nicer quarters.
Right.
Mosquitoes and no rain and no monsoons. But, you know, other than that, yeah.
How do you feel about Vietnam today? I mean, you talked about the development issue and the tourist thing, but just looking at the country today and where it's come since the war, what are your feelings?
Politically, candidly, I don't know much about it. I mentioned before, I think it's one of those potentially a tropical paradise. It's from an economic standpoint, it's very close to Japan and all of the Asian nations. And as the Asian nations obviously gain wealth, they're going to do that because China and all those nations have a lot of people who are willing to work more than 8 to 5 and work very hard. And some of them are going to accumulate wealth, particularly as their societies become more capitalistic. And I feel like they're probably going to wind up going down to Vietnam and that it will wind up being a very a resort type of area eventually.
Would you ever want to go back?
Sure. Yeah, I'd like to go back. I don't have any I don't harbor any dark thoughts or anything of Vietnam that would prevent me from going back. Again, I think that's part of growing. You clear your mind and you accept change. And you understand the same people who may have tortured our troops and so forth probably aren't alive anymore, and new people have come along. And I don't know much about the politics or the government, because I don't read about those type of things. But, I would love to go back and see. In fact, I've been thinking about if I had the money to make this investment opportunity, I probably would do that. And that might include a trip over there just to see what the country's like now.
Right. Okay. Tell me about what you've seen on Vietnam since the war, the books and the movies that have been out. Do you see them? Do you read about the war? And if so, which ones? And if you don't, why not?
It seems like a long time ago. I've forgotten the name of the... I did see the Mel Gibson movie. I can't remember the name of it.
We Were Soldiers?
Yeah. And I did not remember that particular incident and the way it was portrayed, you know, where they kind of got left out, left field there.
Mm-hmm.
There was another one. There were two or three there that were pretty graphic that I never saw. Or I may have seen portions of them. And I forget what one of them was called, about something about Doomsday or, help me.
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now. And I don't think I watched, I may have watched that a long time ago, but I married a lady who doesn't particularly enjoy violence in movies, and I kind of go to movies to walk out feeling good if I can. Now, that's just more recent, but I think at the time either I was too busy or I did not, I just didn't care to, you know, go back to those situations. It wasn't, again, a fear of darkness or anything like that. I just, it was just a choice. There were other things I would want to see, I think.
Right.
I didn't read a lot in the movies. To a certain extent, I avoided it and didn't realize it. Sort of subconsciously avoided it because I just didn't, you know, I was just glad to be rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember that being a feeling that I had. And I'm sure that probably 5 years or 3 years after, I probably, maybe I did a lot of these things. Maybe I read a lot about it. Maybe I got, but I don't remember doing that.
Okay. Bill, let me ask you a general question. Your perception of the Vietnam veteran today, what do you think the public thinks about Vietnam veterans? And are there myths or misconceptions about the veteran?
I think most of the people alive today now are, most of the people alive today, I emphasize most, are so consumed by their own lives, their own wants, needs, greeds, that they don't think about it. I think when you go back to Washington, D.C., and you see the Black Wall, that really made an impression on me. It was a very emotional moment. I cried like a baby.
Tell me about that. When did you go, and what happened?
Seems like it was about 5 to 7 years ago. And just walking along that wall and touching it really... pulled a lot of emotion out of me, and I think that I even I wrote the lyrics to a song recently that I'd be happy to send you, but I want to do it. I don't want you to publish it because it has some strong political beliefs in there, and I'm sure particularly in Lubbock, Texas, it would offend many and maybe think I was a raging liberal or something like that. But I'll I think I have your card, and I'll send you a copy of it.
Okay.
I'm having a fellow write some lyrics to it now, so I'll trust that you don't share it with anybody. But it talks about, I think the chorus is linear minds, technology reigns. We're masters of the dance, showing that we've mastered the technology of war. And all. But what have we done to our souls? Do we still have a chance? And... there's several verses in there. One's about the Black Wall, and I think it's a fair representation of somebody who maybe has been there, and yet has an open mind to how other people think besides our particular culture. And I haven't even shared it with my mother because she has such strong, you know, conservative beliefs that it would only, we'd spend all our time arguing. But, and I don't know what your political beliefs are, you might, but in any event, maybe it would be better if I just, if I can find it here, if I could read it to you. But go ahead.
Okay, while you're looking, and of course realize that if you do read it, that this is part of the audio,
yeah,
which will be part of the public interview.
Yeah. And I don't mind that if somebody, I don't know how many people play this or will see this. Will this be something that'll be, you know, on?
It'll be out there. It'll be on the internet. It'll be here in the archive. And,
yeah, well, I might do it off the record.
Okay, that'll be fine. Whatever you prefer. It seems like, just based on what you've said in the last half hour, that you have really put Vietnam behind you. You do have some strong emotions about it, obviously, based on your experience at the wall. How do you think you've been able to do that? Is it just a determination to do so, or is it because of your experience?
I think just a natural moving on with my life. I'm a person who lives very much in the now and in the future. I have seen people wallow in the past and get stuck in it and regret it and all this stuff. And I'm a very much, it's like my golf game. I have a poor shot, if I don't forget it, in fact, I'll even say to people sometimes, that shot is just as over as the Vietnamese War, the Korean War, and it'll do you about as much good to worry about it because you've got the shot coming up to you. And I project that in my life. I project that in my golf game to just for sanity's purpose. Not sanity, but just a good, healthy attitude. I think, you know, I at my age, I'm starting to go to a bunch of funerals and memorial services. I went to one the other day. I got one Wednesday to go through a client. And I go to them and pay my respects, and then I'm out of there. I don't wallow in that stuff. So I have some very strong beliefs about that. It's kind of let the dead bury the dead type of philosophy.
Okay. Well, Bill, how is participating in this interview in the Oral History Project affected you? Has this been a positive experience, or has it been something, again, just that you wanted to do and you did and it's over with?
I think, you know, as I look at it, the sending of the memorabilia was kind of a clearing all that stuff out of my life. I said, I'm keeping it. What am I keeping it for? When I die, is my daughter going to drag all that up and then not know what it was? Or so you folks provided a wonderful opportunity for me to purge that, if you will, from my basement shop. But secondly, all I think there may have been a little bit of mental purging too, I feel very good about it. I don't feel, God, it's relieved, and I'm
right
over that. That's something I've been carrying around with. It's not that at all. It's just as simply maybe somebody can use this historically. Maybe it will do some good somewhere, or maybe help some students appreciate what went on. But I don't really. I think it's a positive experience. It, quite frankly, it's kind of flattering to me for you to interview me as, you know, somebody, because I don't feel like I played any major role in the war. I wasn't a hero, war hero, or anything like that. And I just think I did my job. And a lot of young people, that might be very glamorous and wonderful, but that would be kind of a caution that I, anybody listening to this, is that war is not glamorous. It's glamorized by the people who pin the medals on because they want to keep the ball rolling, and keep people thinking that they did something wonderful. But it's been a good experience. And when we say goodbye, I'll see you when I'm in Lubbock and visiting my mother occasionally. Mm-hmm. And I wish you the best. You've been a wonderful host, and I obviously think the work that you're doing is very positive, I wish I wish you could be jammed in the face of some of our politicians and leaders, and they could hear some of this stuff before.
Right.
But that probably won't happen.
So, Bill, you went into the reserves, is that correct?
Yeah, I went in school. I had flunked a chemistry course, and so instead of completing my Air Force ROTC contract to be a pilot, I decided that at that time, and we didn't know whether or not we'd be drafted, but I was gung-ho to serve my country, and so I went in the Marine Corps. And it was, you know, I think the Marine Corps has a certain attraction. I see some youngsters in my church going into the Marine Corps because they think it's very glamorous and so forth. And they've got a, you know, if you're going to go be in the service, it's a great place to be because you know you're well-trained and the people who are beside you there volunteer. They weren't drafted, so...
Right. What about afterwards, after December 65, were you ever in the military again?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't go back to reserve or anything.
Okay.
I was quite, I didn't enjoy a lot of, as I mentioned before, I didn't enjoy a lot of the politics of the military, and so I chose to just, you know, I'd done my deal, and it was through.
Okay. All right, Bill. Well, is there anything else that you want to talk about or add to our conversation?
No, I think, for the record, that's probably it.
Okay. Well, very good. We will end the oral history interview now with Mr. Bill Holmes. Thank you very much for your time, sir. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time and the work that you're doing.